Hey, and welcome to FutureThinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, popular episodes, and to join our community, go to FutureThinkers.org/start. All Future Thinkers episodes are now on video. To watch the premiere of each episode and join the discussion live, subscribe to our YouTube channel at FutureThinkers.org/YouTube.
Hey guys, and welcome back to part two of our interview with Douglas Rushkoff, media theorist, lecturer, and author of Team Human. In this part, we continue to discuss the origins of transhumanism, the distrust in the corporate digital environment, and who can challenge the existing structures and create a new, truly interconnected culture.
You can find all the links and show notes for this episode at futurethinkers.org/94. To check out the first part of this interview, go to futurethinkers.org/93.
Check out A Course in Personal Evolution. Adapting Age-Old Wisdom for a Modern Life of Purpose and Meaning. Go to futurethinkers.org/evolution.
The last thing that we were talking about was that so many movements, religious or non-religious, technological, seem to be afraid of being itself, and they're trying to transcend it or eliminate it somehow, either through some kind of religious purity or just avoiding humans altogether or eliminating any aspects that make us human, trying to make us into more machines.
Yeah. I mean, some of that came from Russia, interestingly enough.
Yes, unfortunately.
You know, I write about that in Team Human, that it was, you know, it's partly the Russian Orthodox tradition of Christianity is a little bit more about kind of, you know, transcending the body and, you know, having your own, you know, your soul kind of leaving your body and going up somewhere else. It's a little bit Gnostic. And they, some of these Russian kind of New Age spiritual people from a movement called the Cosmists, they came to San Francisco in the 1980s and 70s as part of a two-track diplomacy program where they met up with the sort of West Coast psychedelic early tech people and really got them all fascinated with the idea of building robots that you could put human consciousness inside and space migration, you know, all these kinds of things. They really launched what in America became the transhumanist movement. And it was really just a way of marrying that Gnostic spiritual urge with the very Western, technological urge, and also this kind of addiction to progress. You know, Americans, we landed on the East Coast and believed that we could just keep going west, and we got to California and Pacific Ocean, and it kind of ended. So it's like, wait a minute, you know, there's nowhere else left to go. And then the Cosmists gave the sort of psychedelic technologists this new frontier. Oh, so now we can keep going forward, never look back. And that's, you know, part of our problem in the West in particular, that we keep going forward and not looking at the devastation that we leave in our wake. You know, we have movie fantasies about robot slaves coming to kill us. And that's partly because we've never dealt with our own legacy of slavery in this country, which is less than, you know, 100 years ago. So it's kind of interesting. Well, you know, what are we escaping from? What are we running from? And what does that do? You know, finally, if you really think you're going to get out, then it doesn't matter what you do to the planet. You know, you just burn everything you can to get out of this thing rather than accept the possibility that we could keep this reality going.
Yeah, it seems like humanity might need some sort of a serious ayahuasca initiation, Jungian psychotherapy, where we look at the shit that we've done and accept our shadow and, you know, try to reconcile.
Right. But the folks who believe in this will say that we are nostalgic. Oh, you're being nostalgic for the human body. You're being nostalgic for human society and for communing with people and sitting around face to face. That's get over it. You know, it's time to move forward, you little old-fashioned biological people.
What is, I'm trying to figure out from your point of view, what is wrong with transhumanism as far as like, I feel like there's that understanding that we lose something in kind of merging with machines or AI. But don't we have a lot to gain as well? So what are we leaving behind by transitioning into or transcending the human form?
99% of it. In other words, we understand a good 1 or 2% of what the human experience is. And if we think that's enough, then okay, go. But the fact that we understand so little about what human consciousness is, what love is, what the soul is, what how rapport works, how the mind, emotions, and spirit function, and that if we were to decide to give it up in order to jump into this sort of minuscule, oversimplified simulation of what a couple of kids at Google think humanity is, then I'm a little concerned. I'm also, and again, this could just be me, but I experience a kind of a sense of pleasure and grounding through the nervous system. You know, there's being able to see and hear and taste and touch are, I don't want to just dismiss them as luxuries. I think that they are, they may be essential to what it means to be a conscious thinking human. And until I know more about the sensory experience, I don't know. I don't want to surrender it.
Do you think you would change your opinion on transhumanism if you knew that the sensory experience was either maintained or improved?
I don't currently have enough trust in Google or Facebook or Intel to replace my eyes with their proprietary algorithms. Yes, if I was blind, I would buy the algorithms and sign the user agreement and understand that they might decide to restrict my eyes' ability to see copywritten material, or government might decide that seeing certain kinds of things is likely to make me less compliant, and that there'll be sudden blank spots in my vision when they've been regulated away, or that, you know, my might not be able to use certain words when I speak with my artificial box because those words have become trademarked by somebody. And I'm only allowed to use words that start with A and A through K, and we'll adjust. I get it.
If you don't buy the Supreme package, then you only get right. Half the alphabet.
And I get it. If I had a medical need to just be able to function, I would do that. But the idea of replacing biology that we don't yet even fully understand with proprietary technologies made by companies who don't have my best interests at heart, I don't buy it. Plus, I think it's really, really naive to believe that we understand. So would you replace your hearing with 44,000 hertz CD-ROM or CD technology? You know, it's better. It's better. Hey, this, I promise you, on paper, right now, I can promise you, a CD can hear lower and hear higher than you can. Replace your hearing with digital CD today. The sampling rate is more than you'd be able to perceive. Replace it now. Why aren't you? Why aren't you? Do you think CD sound is as good as what you hear with your ears? Would you replace it today? I'll give you $20,000. To replace your ears, everything you hear, with CD quality sound. Not SACD, not FLAC files, CD, which we were told was better.
You're talking to a bit of an audiophile here, so that's an automatic no, but.
Oh, my audiophile. Do you remember in the early days, were you around for the early days of CD when they were telling us that this was better than LPs?
Yeah.
And there was one study that was done in Germany with depressed patients where they played them Paco Bell Canon on vinyl and on CD. And all of them got more anxious and depressed when they listened to the CD version. But they all got calm when they listened to the analog. And I kept citing it. And they were all telling me, oh, you're crazy. You're a boomer. You like your records. Yeah. You don't understand. So there you go.
Yeah.
But that's just whether or not my Pink Floyd is going to be affecting my body, you know, from my stereo. Now you're talking about, what's your problem, Doug? Why don't you just take it if they tell you that this is great? And it's because they don't even understand the way. What about synesthesia? What about the way our senses interact with each other? That there turns out they're not even discrete. What about the taste of green? You know?
Yeah. I do think, I mean, the question of right now, would I make that choice really would depend on, is it upgradable and will the resolution improve in the future? If so, I might consider it. But then the point from your book that you make about companies trying to fit us into statistical boxes and kind of like push us into behaving the way the company wants makes me understand your point of view a lot better. I would have actually probably disagreed on this point, but then hearing that, it was really surprising to me that they have these all of these statistical maps of us, but some of us diverge, some of us don't fit. So they go, no, get in there, and they shove us in. Can you talk about that a bit more? Because that was really surprising and interesting to me.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much this has to do with, audiovisual enhancement.
Well, to me, it's the distrust of the company, right? That was the point that I kind of latched onto. It's that you just don't trust anyone who would be offering any of this.
You mean like maybe they wouldn't show you some of this information with the visual processor or auditory processor because it doesn't fit in the box?
Or they would leave the ability to just turn off the visual, you know, you're not allowed to see that trademark, or you're not, like you said, not allowed to use that letter or that word. I mean, leaving that functionality in.
Yeah, I mean, there's two reasons not to go. Right, not to go into the robot tonight. I mean, one of them is fundamental, and we could talk about that later. I mean, one of them is because of capitalism and the surveillance economy and expressing itself through digital tech. So a company like, you know, Facebook or YouTube or whoever, but they're using statistical algorithms to put each one of us in a bucket, in a kind of consumer profile bucket. So they use your past data to figure out what future you're most likely to have. So as Facebook they used to advertise to marketers, they could predict with about 80% accuracy if you're going to go on a diet or decide that you're gay or get divorced or start fertility treatments. And once they know this, once they know with 80% accuracy that you're going to go on a diet, they will start putting messages in your newsfeed about, oh, you're looking kind of fat, or your veins are getting weak, or you better consider better food. And they're not just doing it to promote the products of a particular sponsor, but to get that 80% accuracy up to 85 or 90 or 95%. The enemy of Facebook or YouTube is the 20% of people who are going to do the unpredictable behavior. That's what to these companies, that's noise, right? That's going against their data. So they want to be able to get it up to 85, 90, 95%. The better their prediction, the better they do. But instead of trying to make the predictive algorithms better, they're trying to get us to conform to what the algorithms say is our future. And that's you know, it's shaving off the weird, the anomalous behavior. It's actually getting rid of the most human of us, those who are not robotically going down the prescribed path, but are coming up with new innovative ideas, the strangeness that makes humans interesting. So that, I mean, the further we submit to their platforms and the logic of their platforms, the more of our humanity we surrender to statistics.
Yeah, fair enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you know, but I'm concerned on a more fundamental level that people are ready to discard human reality for a digital facsimile. And I understand. So the simplest way, even before you change yourself, what if you can replace your girlfriend or your wife with a robot? You know, she can have all the good that your wife has, but none of the disagreement, you know, none of the bad. She won't have to go to the bathroom. She won't use up the bathroom time when you want to go in there. She'll always wake up for you to have sex. She'll, you know, it's all the same. I promise. We'll find out all the ways she thinks, all that cute stuff, but we'll take away all that other stuff, you know? And she'll be cheap. She'll just, you just plug her in. You don't have to feed her. You don't have to, you know, earn extra money or whatever.
And self-cleaning.
Self-cleaning. There you go. You could share her too and not have to worry about jealousy, right? She'll still love you the best. She'll be programmed to love you the best. What is that, right? So now we can understand it when it's with someone else. So now I'm saying, look, you can have all of you, but none of you. None of that stuff that you don't like about you. All those challenges, all those things. You won't need food. You won't need, you know, you won't need women. You won't need to dream bad dreams. You can just have, the whole thing will be a dream anyway. So you don't have to even worry about dreams or sleep. Just, you're discarding something you don't understand, and you're accepting, and this is the worst part of it, you're accepting the idea that you are not sacred in any way. You're accepting the idea that there's no such thing as a human soul or in soul. You're saying that humans don't matter, that we just don't, that there's nothing to us. And I think there is something to us. I don't think the simulation of who you are is the same thing as who you are. I mean, is it better than nothing? I mean, I don't think you'll experience anything, but I suppose if we're going to disappear, then it's at least cool for there to be a simulation running so that if someone does show up later, they can see who we were and what we did. I think it's an interesting way to try to store the knowledge of civilization, to store what we figured out so far, but it is death. I think that's what it is. I like where I'm at right now. Let's save this game. And I'm willing to die for that.
Yeah.
So why do you think humans have this impulse to be self-denying in this way?
Well, a lot of reasons. I mean, partly it's the downside of the Judeo-Christian lineage, you know, that we went from a circular understanding of our reality where everything was a reenactment of something else, and where everybody reincarnated, and we understood, you know, reality is regenerative. Once we got the written word, a scribal culture, and we could, you know, record our history and write contracts into the future, we started to think of the world in a more linear fashion. I mean, and the beauty of that was we started to understand the idea of progress. You know, let's make next year better than this year, and this year better than last year. Let's, you know, get people out of slavery. Let's increase social justice. Let's make people more comfortable. Let's make childbirth less painful. You know, there's all these things we can do. But we started to think only in terms of that linear progress, and we lost all of our sense of circularity. So we want to continually escape from whatever it is we've just done. You know, we want to have a car that can drive fast enough to get away from its exhaust. We want to keep traveling west and not remember the slaves that we just hired to get us there. So there's a kind of a a self-loathing that's inherent to a society that just wants to keep moving forward, keep going, keep your eyes on the prize. The ends justify the means. Whoever you're stamping on the way, whatever native people that you had to just destroy in order to grow this stuff, you know, you want to forget about it as quickly as possible. So you start to put the blinders on and just move forward. And when that reaches such an extreme point in the West, where we're pretty much responsible for having destroyed the planet and probably killed the species, what else are you going to do but fantasize, you know, some kind of metropolis heaven place to get away from the devastation we've left in our wake?
I feel like we need to differentiate a bit between the person running towards a creative impulse to want to drive for progress for the sake of building something or making everyone's life better, and people, and then on the other side, people who are running away from something, like you say, running away from the exhaust. Like, it seems like they're all being lumped in one group here.
Yeah, but what is progress really right now? Is the progress, I mean, and it's true. I mean, you look at a guy like Elon Musk, and on the one hand, some of his progress ideas are beautiful, right? Oh, I want to make tunnels that have frictionless transport and blah, blah. I mean, for the most part, he's just building on top of what's already there. He's not challenging any of the fundamental assumptions. It's like, oh, we live in an automobile culture, so I'm going to make automobiles better, rather than why are we submitting to this idea that we have to have automobiles? You know, oh, it's because we built the suburban landscape to require automobiles. Well, you know, what if we were as creative as General Motors was in the 1930s and 40s when they remade America around the automobile? So, you know, there's some lack of creativity if you're totally progress oriented and thinking that we just keep building new platforms on top of the ones that are there. We're accepting the underlying circumstances. So Musk accepts corporate capitalism as a funding model for everything. He accepts the automobile as the primary mode of transportation. So none of what they're doing is disruptive. It's all additive. But there are if I were thinking about progress, I would be thinking about progress in terms of how can we help people establish rapport with one another? You know, I think we are moving into a small is beautiful realm. You know, where for the most part, we're still right now using digital technology in the industrial model or in the television era model. It's all about advertising and attention and mass scale, mass production and all. It's like, no, digital opens up a whole other way of understanding things, and it's a much more scaled, distributed understanding of the world. And if we started thinking that way, then we're going to start looking at, oh, we've got to improve our human relationships, we've got to enhance the connection between teachers and their pupils. You know, when we think about digital education, we who are still stuck in the industrial age, in the television age, think of it as, oh, let's create, you know, million person MIT MOOC classrooms. It's like, no. What you want to do is figure out the digital sensibility might be no tech at all in a classroom, but something that's actually scaled to scaled to the human body, back scaled into that distributed way. It's more, it's the kind of subsidiarity that was talked about by the Catholic Church back in the 1900s.
You mentioned the platforms that keep building on top of each other. Do you feel like there's some necessity for us to have a bit of creative destruction to kind of reset the platform so people start innovating on a fresh landscape?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it creative destruction, because that just is basically become a libertarian excuse for destroying people's lives. You know, it's okay. All of you people are going to be hurt, but this one billionaire is going to be fine. And for him, it's profit in the same old way. For you, it's creative destruction. Mm-hmm. So I don't buy that. But yeah, I do think we can challenge the systems that we take for granted. You know, we can challenge the idea that, oh, I need a car in order to get to work. I need to spend one day of my week working to pay for the car that I need to get to work. I think that's something that could be challenged, you know, or, well, so much. We could challenge the idea that the economy needs to grow at an accelerating rate in order for it to stay still. That can be challenged because human beings are now at the mercy of a system that needs to grow. Perhaps for that operating system to grow, corporate capitalism to grow, we all need to surrender our bodies and buy robots. That would increase GDP, but would it increase anything else positively? I don't know.
Who do you think are some of the people who are actually challenging these kinds of underlying structures right now that are prominent?
You know, that little girl from Sweden, what's her name? Greta, is it?
Greta,
the,
yes.
The one who's, she's she's challenging some things.
I don't know who this is. What's the story
behind
this?
She's a climate change activist.
And she's like 14 years old or something. And she's more articulate about it than most grown-ups. You know, she's kind of become one of the figureheads of the Extinction Rebellion movement and, you know, leading the kids to go out of school and tell their parents that, and grown-ups that we have to stop destroying the world, stuff like that. Yeah. You know, the fact that at that age they're saying, look, we're not going to get to live the rest of our natural lives. That's real. I feel like they're standing up. I mean, and beyond those sorts of activists, I think it's the artists who do that. You know, they're the ones who, artists are the ones who can celebrate something beyond utility value. You know, it's so easy in a technosphere to say, does this have more or less utility than what I already have? Oh, and this claw is going to have more utility than my hand. I have a moral obligation to replace my hand with that claw, and to earn the money I need to buy the claw. Artists understand that there's some other kind of value than utility value. It's not how quickly I can produce more stuff. It's, you know, that my experience itself, my way of interacting with others, is itself has some core value, some fundamental value that doesn't yet have a metric.
I'm really surprised there's not a resurgence of the old punk rock movement, you know, the challenging the status quo, bring down although this time it wouldn't necessarily be against like the Republican kind of governing system. It might be against like corporate America and leftism and this sort of thing. But I feel like it's a perfect breeding ground for a new punk rock movement, but it's just not happening.
Well, in a weird way. I mean, this is really awful to say. I mean, in a weird way, the Trump movement is,
yeah,
kind of has punk elements.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, not musically, but in the idea that we like that you find us ugly and horrible.
Yeah.
You know, there was that. It's like, I'm going to pierce my face enough that my own mother can't look at me. And that's going to give me pleasure. You know, and here I feel like Trump is, it's like, we're going to say and feel things that are so deplorable. You know, they love that the best thing for Trump was when Hillary Clinton called them deplorables.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, now we've got you to admit how you actually see us. Hmm. You know, rock on.
Yeah, I can see the intellectual dark web people being kind of part of that group. Like they're.
Yeah. And in some, you know, and the what fuels them is the justifiable outrage at the way that it's really the way that a digital environment treats our history. Hmm. You know, you can't say anything now that may 10 years from now be something that we've moved on from. In other words, you can't ask, I can't, if there's some unresolved questions about feminism or sexuality or race or something, that if it might be politically okay to say it now or to wonder or ask a question, 10 years from now, it might be considered an outrageous affront to women or to race or to something, and you're going to be in trouble for it. You know, that's where it's getting... That's where it's getting strange.
That's so Orwellian. So
yeah.
It is, though, but it is. So, you know, in the 1970s, scientists and geneticists were asking seriously if different races might have different propensities or different abilities. You know, is it more likely, you know, just asking this gets one in trouble now.
Yeah.
They would ask seriously, though, is it more likely for an African-American to be able to play basketball well than an Irish-American? And if so, why? Is there, are Black American men genetically predisposed to be, you know, taller or stronger or to jump higher or whatever? And that was the kind of thing that they were asking in this really controversial book, The Bell Curve. Mm. And, you know, it led to all these arguments, and the guy was kind of a racist, you know, who wrote it and whatever. But it's like, you could ask those questions, or are women better suited to certain kinds of careers? Are women genetically predisposed to be more nurturing because they're mothers? And does that make them better to be nurses? And men are more violent, so that makes them better to be surgeons who, you know, cut into bodies or something. And if someone finds someone asking those questions on a podcast in 1995, and now they're going up for a university president position in 2020, that's it. We found the evidence. It's there.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought of that. That
you know,
be so afraid to say anything that will be in the future offensive. But that's, of course.
But that's, of course, how it works. That's the thing. I mean, because at least in the moment, in the context that the person was saying it, it didn't seem so bad. Now, I understand some of it is really bad in any context, you know. And you know, you can go to things that people were saying in the 1950s, calling Black people boy, you know, those people are still alive. Those people still are loved by their grandchildren, and they may, probably don't do it anymore. Or maybe they believe these things. Who knows? You know, so, but there's awful stuff that's just awful throughout. But what the dark web people are kind of arguing that the fear of being able to say anything has now put so many topics off the table that we could get into a certain kind of trouble.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, I teach in a media studies department that has a lot of people who are very much into identity politics. Mm. You know, and they understand, and it's okay, again, they understand intersectionalism as the understanding your exact intersection. You know, I am a Black, female, gay, Southerner, you know, and that's my thing, you know, and I understand intersectionalism as collective, as, you know, we each have our that we're looking at our intersections. You know, that, yeah, you're a Black gay woman, this, and I'm a white Jewish, you know, weird that, but we intersect at, you know, where's our intersection?
Human.
Not, and there's this, a kind of a surrender to the digital categorization of people, you know, using intersectionalism to isolate and alienate rather than to find common ground. But that's a conversation I'm not allowed to have. Mm. If I try to have that conversation in my institution, that's kind of a privileged white cis looking male asking that someone deny their identity or something. Yeah. And it's not. I'm looking at how can we use intersectionalism to reunite our species.
Yeah, look for, you know, common ground.
Yeah, but that's them's fighting words, you know. And if I want to keep my job or keep my Twitter following or keep my ability to publish, I have to tread extremely carefully. Can't do thought experiments. You can't, because they might reveal my dark side, you know. They might reveal the part that I don't yet, you know, that needs to be understood and addressed. And it's interesting. So we live in a culture that on the one hand, we have these digital media that are trying to get us to act like reptiles and to spout the worst possible stuff. And on the other hand, we're living in a politically correct society where even wondering something out loud can get you into permanent career trouble. That's a really difficult path to walk.
Yeah, I think about a lot about the differences in generations and how they look out at the world and see opportunity or see risk. And this new generation, I suppose, that I'm a part of, seems to be pretty ruled by fear. And there's sort of this, like, you talk about the uber geek who goes into the organization and just decides to do something, gets mentorship from these capitalists, and then just goes down this deep, dark rabbit hole of inventing things that will destroy the world. And then there's the other side where I feel like people are so focused on social justice and equality, and not equality, but equity. And I'm looking for where the middle ground of a culture emerges, where people actually see the world for what it is and kind of look at the problems for what they are, because there's not a lot of truth when we're actually speaking.
How do you mean that?
There's not a lot of actual observation of what reality is. There's everyone's individual perspective, and we seem to have lost the ability to communicate with one another about what we actually, what each other experiences, not just what, you know, my individual perspective. Like, this intersectionality seems to fragment us more and more, divide us more and more, instead of, like you say, finding the crossroads. So I suppose I'm curious of what your perspective on younger generations are. Like, do you have hope that we're figuring it out, or do you have pessimism?
I have some hope. I don't see as much device addiction among younger kids as I think most adults see and fear. There were always the mean girls, you know, who would go to the mall or do the thing and leave out other people. They're still there. And because they're the mean girls and the mean boys, of course, but I'm thinking about the movie, like Mean Girls. I mean, that sort of type. I knew that table. There was a table of popular kids, popular, horrible kids in the middle school cafeteria. And they're still there, and they are, and their value system is really well represented in the, you know, Kardashian-driven social media nonsense. But they're such a minority, and they always have been. You know, the funny thing about the popular girls is that the popular kids have the fewest friends, right? Because they're popular, they're exclusive. And I feel like that these technologies, at least as far as their generation, it looks to me like they're appealing to that small band of popular kids who weren't actually popular, but exclusive, and that other kids are spending time in the real world. I mean, I know people talk about, they see it again. Oh, I see two kids walking down the street and they're both, you know, they're texting each other on their phones and whatever, or they're not looking at each other. I mean, there is some extent that when they're in transit, when they're between places, this is an American thing, that you're on your phone to, like, be navigating as if everything between your activities is an opportunity to be doing something else. You know, you don't, walking is not an opportunity to look around and find other people. It's an opportunity to get your stuff done. But I am hopeful about the younger generation being able to walk out of school and protest what's happening in the climate, that they are woke in a particular way. So no, I think the beauty of neuroplasticity is not just that the human brain conforms to the media system that it's in, but the human brain learns how to develop adaptive strategies for the media environment that they're in. So young people growing up in a digital media environment are more resistant to this stuff than we are.
Yeah. It seems like, yeah, I mean, humans are just kind of teenagers in their interaction with technology right now. We haven't learned how to do it intelligently, and we haven't learned impulse control and all of this. But I do think that will come with time.
Yeah. I mean, it's whether or not the human ability to develop impulse control will grow faster than a multi-trillion dollar industry's ability to thwart our impulse control. You know, that's where the money at Stanford is not going into how do we help people resist these technologies. It's going into how do we utterly control people who are using them.
Douglas, thanks for joining us. This has been fun.
Thank you.
All right, that's it for our conversation with Douglas Rushkoff. To get all the links and show notes for this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/94. To listen to the first part of the interview, go to futurethinkers.org/93.
And if you want to stay up to date with our latest episodes, blog posts, or news from Future Thinkers, join our mailing list at futurethinkers.org/mailing list. To meet like-minded people, join our Future Thinkers Discord community. Go to futurethinkers.org/discord.
Check out A Course in Personal Evolution, adapting age-old wisdom for a modern life of purpose and meaning. Go to futurethinkers.org/evolution.
Don't forget to subscribe and hit the bell icon to get notified of new videos. You can also follow us on social media to stay connected. If you'd like to get a t-shirt like the new Make America Think Again, go to futurethinkers.org/store. If you like what we do and you want to help us make more podcasts and videos, consider donating or becoming a patron at futurethinkers.org/support. Also visit our sponsor Qualia and use the coupon code FUTURE to get 10% off your purchase.